Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, things are going to get a little nerdy. Okay. Things are going to get super, super nerdy, but particularly for you compliance and history connoisseurs among us. There is no shortage of articles and speeches that you could dig into to try and understand the technical aspects of running your compliance program. But today, we're going to do something a little more colorful than that. On today's episode of the podcast, we review legends and myths from cultures around the world that teach us a lesson about life, compliance, and shine a light on some of the nuances and best practices we can glean from those stories to improve the compliance programs inside your firm. In our headline section, we look at the recent rulemaking on ESG disclosures and investment company naming conventions. And finally, we'll wrap up today's show with another installment of Outtakes, where we look at a new version of pandemic frauds that provides compliance professionals with similar lessons to communicate inside our respective firms. Diving into the headlines portion of the show, on May 25th, 2022, the SEC proposed significant ESG disclosure requirements, asserting that the amendments would create a, quote, consistent, comparable, and decision-useful, end quote, regulatory framework for ESG advisory services and investment companies. The SEC also proposed amending Form NSEN and Form ADV to align annual reports with similar disclosure requirements. The proposal primarily looked at three types of ESG-focused investment companies and the disclosure requirements each would have to follow, including, first, funds that consider ESG factors would be required to describe the role ESG factors play in determining the investment strategy. Second, ESG-focused funds, which consider ESG factors to be crucial or critical to their investment decisions, would be required to provide additional disclosure, including a standardized ESG strategy overview. And finally, what are known as impact funds, a subset of ESG-focused funds that strive towards a specific ESG-related goal, would be required to disclose the progress that the funds are making towards that specific goal. For investment companies to consider ESG factors in their investment strategy, the amendments would require disclosing information about the goals they are seeking to achieve and the metrics they use to measure progress. Certain investment companies would be also required to report greenhouse gas emissions data, such as carbon footprints and the weighted average carbon intensity of their portfolios. SEC Chair Gensler supported the proposal, saying that it would provide investors with, quote, consistent and comparable disclosures about asset managers' ESG strategies so they can understand what data underlies funds claims and choose the right investments for them. Commissioners Crenshaw and Lee, as one might expect, also supported the proposal, highlighting the need for a specific disclosure regime and encouraging public comment. SEC Commissioner Peirce objected to the amendments and stated that ESG-related disclosure should not be a priority for the SEC given its ability to enforce already existing rules and laws regarding material misstatements using certain provisions under the existing Advisors Act, like the anti-fraud provision. Additionally, Ms. Peirce noted that the lack of an explicit definition of ESG could render enforcement of these requirements difficult and at times costly. Moving to our next headline, the SEC also proposed new requirements to prevent misleading investment company names. This was to Rule 35D1 of the Investment Company Act, commonly known as the Names Rule, and the amendments were to address certain broad categories of investment company names that are likely to mislead investors about an investment company's investment and risks. The amendments would increase disclosure requirements and record-keeping requirements, and specifically, the rule proposal would require that funds with certain names, such as those suggesting kind of similar to the topic we just discussed, those wanting an environmental, social, and governance policy, invest at least 80% of their assets in investments consistent with that name, and only limited exceptions would be permitted, such as where there is a material change in the value of assets owned by the fund. The proposal would also prohibit closed-end funds and business development companies that do not have listed shares from changing their 80% policy without a shareholder vote. It would require a fund to provide additional disclosure on how it tracks its investments. The amendments would prohibit a fund that does not consider ESG factors as an essential aspect of its strategy from using ESG or other similar terminology in its name. I'll add anecdotally, that seems like it would be different individuals might take very different interpretations as to what similar terminology might be, but I digress. And finally, the rule proposal would modernize the process for notifying shareholders of changes to the 80% investment policy requirement. Granted, the policy is not imperative to the fund's ability to operate to account for electronic delivery. Again, similar to the first proposal on ESG, Chair Genzo supported the amendment, stating that it will address, quote, gaps in the current names rule that may undermine investor protection. Commissioner Crenshaw joined in support, calling it a step in the right direction and bringing market practices in line with investor expectations. And Commissioner Lee also supported the proposal, stating that this was necessary given the increasing investor demand for these types of sustainable investments. Similar to the first proposal, Commissioner Peirce again dissented. She asserted that the proposed rules may create more, quote, may create more fog than they dissipate and may place unnecessary constraints on fund managers. Additionally, Ms. Peirce expressed concern that the proposal would handcuff funds looking to design creative investment strategies, which may have a detrimental effect on the freedom a fund has to manage its strategy. And I certainly think there is some merit to those arguments, in that managers wanting to be dynamic may be far less inclined to do so. They may be more reticent to do so, given some of these additional strictures in place. As we move into the interview section of today's show, we're going to be doing things a little differently today. For many of our listeners, I know you have really come to enjoy the deep dive interviews we do with so many fantastic guests on some of the technical aspects of compliance and securities regulations. We thought we might take a slightly nuanced approach to those typical podcasts and expand on an idea that occurred at the NSCP National Conference last year in a conversation I had with Ashley, one of our guest panelists. As many of the listeners of this podcast know, we often will do a final segment of the show that we like to call History Has Your Back. And as a quick reminder, maybe for some of our new listeners, that segment represents a part of the podcast where we often go back in time to help us better understand the present and help define where we're headed in the futures as it relates to investment management and the financial markets. We've looked at, you know, letters from Caesar to Cicero there. We even recently looked at the mythology and legend of martial artist Bruce Lee. It's in that spirit that we came up with the idea for today's show involving compliance and mythology. And to set the table a little bit, I want to talk about how, you know, everyone, certainly people are familiar with at least some versions or iterations of mythology and legends. Many people maybe even taken a course in high school or college around the classics or, you know, other cultures and their legends and myths. One of the things that strikes me as interesting is, you know, everyone hears a story differently. And I have personally always been fascinated by the ideas surrounding legends and myths from different cultures and how history and mythology are often wholly intertwined in a way that demonstrates and can define an entire culture and even how we live as a society. In many ways, these stories can act as a mirror that reflects the kinds of values and lessons that we hold dear to us as people, and that often leave an indelible mark on us and help influence how we behave in our own lives and how our lives ultimately take shape. We, as listeners of this podcast could also attest, we talk a lot here about shaping culture and the culture of compliance inside our firms. And all of this led to a conversation I had with one of the guests of today's show, Miriam Lefkowitz, at the 2021 NSCP National Conference, where we talked about how there are certain myths and legends that even came up during our conversation, which may have been, you know, the creative juices may have been organically enhanced based on things that we were drinking at the time. But nonetheless, it provided us with this really great subject matter. And ultimately, I am so excited to welcome Miriam here to share some of her thoughts on the subject, as well as John Walsh, who, for those who know both Miriam and John, who both have previous stops with the SEC, who have been, you know, longstanding innovators and thought leaders in the securities regulations and investment management space, and who also, I think, have a bit of that creative itch to them as well. And also just happen to be really great at compliance too. So Miriam, John, thank you so much for joining the podcast today. We are so thankful that you're here and really, really excited to hear you share your thoughts.
Thank you, Patrick. So I guess I'm going to jump in and start talking about
I think so. That's a good, maybe we'll set the table too a little bit with, you know, one of the things that we thought about in the course of the conversation that Miriam and I had, and John has even written about kind of the lessons we can learn, the historical lessons we can learn, and how kind of the etymology of compliance in a variety of different capacities. But what we talked about is how, you know, it would be really cool to take a look at some of these different myths and legends from around the world, different cultures, and talk about the source, talk about what about the myth or legend was so important to you, and what spoke about it to you, kind of really get into the nitty gritty details of the story, and then maybe provide some commentary, right, about how that story relates to compliance. And so as Miriam and I were having this conversation, you know, one of the ideas she had was taking a look back at the classics, right? Probably a lot of the myths and the legends that many of us may have grown up with, or that certainly, you could probably just take a look at any Marvel Comic Studio movie right now and see remnants of it left there and some of the characters that it discusses in other areas. So anyway, with that, maybe I'll kick it over to you, Miriam, to share your specific myth or legend. And we would love to hear why it's important to you, the story, and maybe a little bit of commentary to compliance.
Thank you, Patrick. I'm excited to talk about this. This is fun. And I think in contrast to a lot of the podcasts that you do where people may want to take notes, this is more like grab your beverage of choice and some cookies before bedtime. And there's still some good nuggets in here. So as you just said, we're going to start talking about Greek and Roman myths. And I think, you know, that's a good place to start. There's a lot of familiarity, so much of America's intellectual history is really based on the Greeks and the Romans. And so their mythologies are widely known. So we're going to see if we can take an interesting spin here. So just for those of you who may not be as familiar, so the Olympics are named for Mount Olympus, which is where the major gods, the Greek gods, lived. And, you know, our very word Ceres comes from the goddess Ceres, or Latin, it would be Ceres, who is the goddess of rain. She's the Roman goddess. And there's a wonderful series for those of you with kids by Rick Riordan, which talks about the Greek gods, the Roman gods, and how they still exist. So it's very much, I think, a part of our modern day culture. And interestingly, the Romans were spectacular engineers and architects, but they were not as creative on the religion and mythology side. And in large part, they adapted the Greeks and the Greek gods to their own. Not entirely, but most of the major gods and goddesses had counterparts. The Greeks had counterparts. So you probably know about Zeus. Zeus was the god of the sky god, the god of thunder. He was the king. He ruled as the king of the gods on Mount Olympus. He's famous for having saved his siblings from Cronos, who had swallowed them, and he married his sister, Hera. And the same story applies to Jupiter, who was the son of Saturn. So there's some very strong parallels. Zeus is also the known as the father of Athena. Athena is a really important goddess. She's the goddess of wisdom and strategy. She's called Minerva, or Minerva in Latin. And she's said to have emerged in full armor, battle ready, straight from Zeus or Jupiter's head. So Zeus has a raging headache, and he asks Hephaestus, who's essentially a carpenter, but a god, to take an axe and chop his head open so that his pain will be alleviated, and out pops Athena, fully formed. And it's pretty much the same story for the Romans. But this is where there's a big divergence, and this is where I want to go back and take a closer look, is the origin story on the Greek side is a much richer story, because although she's treated as solely the child of Zeus, on the Greek side, Athena has a mother, whereas Minerva has no counterpart. Minerva's mother has no mother. And the mother of Athena is called Metis, and she was lost to the Romans. And let's talk about Metis. So the story begins with the Titans. The Titans were a race of powerful immortals who preceded the gods of Olympus. They were easily threatened, and they could be vengeful and jealous. Cronos and Rhea were two Titans who were married, or whatever the version was, and they had six children together, each of whom eventually became an Olympian himself or herself. Cronos had heard a prophecy that one of his children would overthrow him, and Cronos had overthrown his own father, so he knew to take this seriously. And so he swallowed each of his children as they were born. Rhea was devastated by this, and she tricked her husband into swallowing a rock that was swallowed like a baby, and sent when her youngest Zeus was born, and sent Zeus off to be raised by Cronus's own mother. When Zeus grew up, he enlisted Metis, who was descended from a different line of Titans, to help avenge his siblings. Metis was the embodiment of deep thought, of wisdom, of cunning, and of prudence. So I find that a very interesting combination. We're going to learn about that. Cunning and prudence. And she also had the gift of prophecy. And if you know anything about Greek or Roman mythology, that indeed is not a very good gift to have, to be prophetic. So Zeus enlists Metis to help him develop this emetic and trick Cronos into essentially vomiting forth all of his siblings, including the rock. And Zeus emerges as the undisputed king of the cosmos. And you think it's a great celebration, and he marries Metis, and life is good for a short while. But Metis, as we know, is a prophet. And she shares with Zeus a prophecy that they're going to have two children, a son who will be stronger than his father and one day take over, and a daughter who will be even wiser than her mother. So given this family history of jealousy, this is a shocking lapse, in my view, of both cunning and prudence by Metis. But it happens. And Zeus had also taken a fancy to Hera, whom he later marries. And Metis didn't really pick up on this either. So she had her flaws, as does everyone. So in a playful moment, Zeus persuades Metis to turn into a little fly, and then he swallows her. And this is because he's afraid. He doesn't know when she's going to have a son or a daughter, and he's afraid of being overtaken. Unbeknownst to him, Metis is already pregnant with a daughter. So Metis, being very clever, crafts a spear, a helmet, a shield, full suit of armor for Athena, who turns out to be the daughter, and imparts on her all the wisdom and all of her power. She pours herself so fully into her daughter that she soon fades into pure thought. And months go by, or however long gestation is for gods, that's what happens here. And at some point, Athena is ready to go, and she bangs and clangs and starts making a tremendous ruckus and causes this raging headache. And that's when Hephaestus comes in and takes the axe. So Athena emerges from Zeus's mind in full glory, wearing this magnificent armor. She becomes the goddess of wisdom and of strategy and of warfare and actually also of crafts. So what happens to the son of power and prudence, who was to be the future, the once and future king, I suppose, the future king anyway, he's never born. And Olympus eventually fades, first in Greece and then in Rome. There is no future for them. So that's the story we're going to talk about. I see some parallels to compliance. What do you think, guys?
Absolutely. I see some parallels to compliance, though I would be interested. And maybe we'll kick off the conversation by, I'm going to turn the question back on you, but I'm going to rephrase it slightly, which is maybe, Miriam, of some of the common themes in that myth or legend, what's the one or maybe the one or two things that stand out to you most that might be good lessons learned for your compliance officer or securities law practitioners out there.
Sure. So first, I'm just going to ask for some indulgence. Obviously, the story is not about securities compliance, but I do think we can have some fun. And then some disclaimers. So if I'm going to, I don't actually think that CEOs are thundering megalomaniacs or that compliance professionals are dooms, but I do think that there are amalgamations of qualities here that we can use for lessons. So with that said.
Duly granted.
Thank you.
Duly granted.
I love Zeus as the senior executive here, right? Because Zeus has earned his place at the top, but he's highly fouled, right? He has actual authority to assign roles, and he does, in fact, lead the other gods, and he works hard to make sure they share common purposes. I think many of us have experience with some senior leaders who thunder an awful lot. So I think the thunder is a nice parallel there. He can be hasty. Can occasionally take credit for work done by others, particularly here. He didn't grant, he didn't credit Metis with saving his siblings. And there's some element of paranoia here, which there can be suspicion sometimes in terms of management. And of course, a lack of business continuity planning. So I think that if we start with that approach and think about, how to build structure around that, recognize that there are some elements, right? There are talents and weaknesses that often exist in people. I think that's an interesting, we can put some people in that corner. And then we bring in Metis. And Metis is a really interesting character, right? She's prudence. I like thinking of compliance as being, as having a lot of Metis's qualities, right? Prudence and wisdom to start, right?
Sure.
But what do we know? She causes the CEO a headache. Terrible.
Mary, I have to admit, when I was listening to the story, I was thinking if compliance participated in the meeting, they probably would have been the one to put their hand up and say, are you sure taking an axe to his head is a good idea? that's what we would call a high risk solution to the problem.
It's true. And probably had Metis been able to advise him, she might have advised something different.
Yeah,
but she was indisposed at the moment. So, I think that, what does Metis do? So let's talk about her strengths, because she has plenty of weaknesses too, and we can learn from those. But, her fundamental role is to protect, in this case, we'll talk business continuity, to protect at large, protect the business at large. She has to make sure the next generation is prepared. She's not going to get any recognition for it, but she's ensuring the future. She's not flashy, but she does what needs to be done behind the scenes to make sure that the wisdom is there and it goes on.
Boy, that certainly sounds like somebody I think I know that works inside a lot of respective firms in the regulated space. Sorry.
We've all seen that, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So what is she? She's also known for cunning. So are there lessons for us in cunning? And I think there are, if we think of it as creative cleverness, as ways to be persuasive. So I don't really think that regulators are titans here. But let's just say that regulators can be threatened sometimes by unfamiliar business lines, and that regulations can be blunt instruments at best, right? And when you have a new product or new business line or new offering, what you need is a combination of both the cleverness and the wisdom of compliance, and then the business. You need both elements to partner together to persuasively move forward. Neither alone is going to be able to bring you to the future. If too much compliance, there's not going to be enough expansion, and business without compliance isn't going to be able to be effective. So I think that there are elements of cleverness there and partnership.
It's funny, when we get to later on in the session, we're going to talk about cleverness and cunning again. And it's an interesting theme. Because you're right, I think compliance to navigate the system, there are titans on one side, there are thunderbolts coming down on the other, and yet compliance and prudence needs to navigate through all that, and it needs to be cunning, it's a little strong, let's try clever. Clever sounds okay. But I hear what you're saying. I think that's a really interesting point that this theme has come up twice, or will come up twice today.
And another theme that you also talked about in there, Miriam, that, again, I think will be one of the themes that kind of manifests itself from the myth and legend that I'm going to share, is this idea a little bit, I don't want to go too far, but of kind of like selflessness, right? Or certainly of this notion that I'm going to do what's ultimately going to be in the best interests of some other thing other than myself, whether it's, you know, in this case, it was, you know, her child, and in protecting that and in protecting the future and all that, you know, that goes along with it. It's going to be slightly different, the story I tell, but this idea that compliance is often very much on the front lines and in a very difficult position, and oftentimes maybe needing to sacrifice in order to help move or push their respective firms into a better place and help secure its future.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And so we talked also about, so these are some strengths of compliance. So, and strengths of Metis. Metis is deeply flawed, right? She has a lot of problems. So we can learn from those too. So the first is, let's talk about prophecy. So I don't think it takes, I think most compliance professionals don't have to be oracles to see when businesses progress, when you're bringing in new opportunities so quickly and they haven't been fully vetted, whether it's supervision, testing, risk assessment, and so forth, you can see that there's going to be trouble downstream, right? So we're all prophets that way. In the story of Metis, the problem is she shares her vision with Zeus, who has absolutely no tolerance for it. So there are lessons here, which is, it's appropriate to put on the brakes when you're in compliance. There has to be balance, as we've just mentioned. And it's not that you shouldn't share your concerns, but if you're thought of as the quote business prevention unit, and we've all heard that phrase, you're going to get cut out. You're going to lose your audience. So prophecy in this sense is a double-edged sword. Metis should have prepared herself for what's to come, for the compliance professional. We should be prepared to, you know, fix, you know, sometimes we have to build the landing gear in mid-flight. If we're such doomsayers, we're going to be cut out. And so there has to be a balance there. We have to learn not to be too negative, because we're not going to get a seat at the table if we have it.
I think that's another great point. Yeah.
That's one of her weaknesses. Another is, how did she actually get deceived, right? She's wisdom and prudence. And I think she was seduced by his flattery. And this is a legitimate risk for compliance professionals, because, you know, senior compliance people should have a C-suite, should have a seat at the table. They should be a member of C-suite. They should recognize, though, that their goal is to be a counterbalance sometimes to the business. And if you get swept in, and here, you know, this part of the myth isn't super well developed, but, you know, she had her own superpowers. And I think she subordinated them to fit in to Zeus's playful game. And that was really her downfall. So it's very natural. We should, you know, there's no reason if you're in compliance, you can't be friends with members at through every level of your firm. I think the lesson is simply not to forget what your superpowers are and what your role is, and to lose sight of that.
That's a great point. Yeah. You want to build rapport, and you want to build camaraderie, and you want to build a relationship with the various business units and or, you know, firms, clients that you help represent in this space. But you don't want to let it go so far that you've completely let your guard down, that you no longer are able to plant a flag when you have to, that you've, you know, essentially, like you say, subordinated some of the very qualities and characteristics that ultimately may have led you to be in the position that you're in right now. Right.
And that's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, I always joke that, you know, compliance is not a good field for people who haven't gotten over the popularity bug. You know, you're going to have to make unpopular decisions. You know, when you walk into the room, people are not always going to be so excited to see you when you have a clipboard, you know, when you look like you're there to work as opposed to just catch up. But I think that's one of the lessons we can learn. And then my favorite takeaway is that, you know, wisdom and strategy, here we have Athena, is the union of leadership and prudence. It doesn't happen. One doesn't exist. You know, it takes both elements. One is more prominent, but both are necessary and present. And then the last part is that, you know, the value was quickly forgotten by the Romans, right? Prudence was forgotten in Athena, in her whole backstory. And I think the lesson here is, don't be too humble. Don't fade too far into the background. It is necessary sometimes, you know, Patrick, as you were saying, to exercise some of that and to be in the background. But, you know, I firmly believe compliance needs a seat at the table. And if we're up to me, we'd have a seat on Mount Olympus. So that's what I got.
Nice. That was a strong ending, too.
I worked on that one. Thank you. You
accentuated that with an exclamation point.
Miriam, I have to admit, I'm still thinking about this whole idea of compliance as oracle. And
okay.
I love it. I love it. And you kind of mentioned it in passing at the beginning that things usually don't go well for oracles in classic mythology. Yeah. And that's kind of a role that compliance has, isn't it? Because it's compliance who says, mark my words, or you'll be sorry, or this goes too far, or whatever it might be. And it seems to be a really important part of the whole classical mythology. The person who predicts the future like that usually does not come out well in the story.
Maybe the difference we can say also is that the difference between Metis and Athena is Athena is the CEO here, the senior management, Zeus, has stake in Athena. There's a tone from the top, right? He's firmly committed because it's his offspring. And Metis didn't have that. So again, you need the buy-in. There's buy-in from senior management. You can lose that if you are unduly critical of the future, or you know, you're always so negative. So Patrick, I know you have an interesting myth that maybe from a different background, that may be a little less familiar to some of the listeners.
Yeah, no, thanks. Well, one, that really absolute applause to you on finding a great myth from the classics. And one that, even though I think lots of people are familiar with the Greek and Roman gods, at least to some extent, finding a character that at least I had not necessarily, I wasn't particularly familiar with, but has a really interesting story. So when I was kind of prepping for this particular podcast and looking around at some of the different myths and legends from around the world, one of the myths or legends that I had come across was in Chinese mythology, the goddess of compassion, Bodhisattva Guanyin. And Bodhisattva Guanyin is a deity of mercy and compassion. It is said that, you know, she is swathed in white and standing atop a lotus pedestal, often maybe a willow branch in one hand, a vase of pure water in the other. Again, she is this goddess of mercy and compassion, and she observes and feels all sounds of suffering in the world. And that is actually the meaning of the name Guanyin. And so Bodhisattva is a title that refers to this kind of rank of spiritual attainment that is above Arhat and below Buddha. Legends about Guanyin first appeared in the Middle Kingdom more than 2,000 years ago. Her popularity really exploded during the Song Dynasty. So that's from the 10th century through the 13th century. And she continues to be kind of hailed and worshipped as the goddess of mercy, even to this day. And so her origin story, if you'll humor me a little bit here, essentially goes like this. Long ago, in a small Chinese state, a king had three daughters. And pursuing worldly gain, he wanted to marry them off to suitable families. His youngest, Miao Shan, had a different wish. She wanted to become a Buddhist nun and essentially perfect herself through spiritual cultivation so that she could bring salvation to the world. I'll add parenthetically, you know, she wanted to be a compliance officer, right? I may have added that last part a little bit, but I think the theme still applies. And, you know, look, unfortunately, the king did not share the same position that his daughter did. And in fact, the king disowned his daughter and sent her into exile. So years pass and the king becomes deathly ill. And an old monk visiting the kingdom told him, you know, to be cured, you must ingest a potion distilled from the arms and eyes of one who is willing to give them freely. And desperate to find a cure, the king implored his older daughters, who were unwilling to help. And the monk then offered, you know, on top of Fragrant Mountain lives a Bodhisattva of compassion. Send a messenger to her and plead for deliverance. So this wandering monk that was advising the king proved out to be none other than the transformation of Miao Shan. After years of arduous spiritual practice, honing her technical craft, she had become a Bodhisattva. Having heard of her father's trouble, she morphed into the monk to advise the king. And then at the temple on Fragrant Mountain, she received her father's messenger in her true form and told him, you know, this illness that the king is suffering from is punishment for past sins. But as his daughter, it is my filial duty to help. She then removed her eyes and severed her arms for the messenger to take back to the king. Back in the kingdom, the old monk reappeared to concoct this magical elixir that gave the king a miraculous recovery. The king was extremely grateful toward the monk, who simply replied, "Best thank the one that made this sacrifice for you." So the king traveled back to Fragrant Mountain, or I should say traveled for the first time to Fragrant Mountain. And there he was shocked to see his daughter presiding over hundreds of followers. And of course, now without arms and eyes. Tears fell from his kingly eyes as he came to realize all that she must have suffered. However, Miao Shan received him benevolently and, in fact, bade him to live with compassion and to practice Buddhism. And then a flash of light engulfed them all as she transformed into the divine image of a bodhisattva with eyes and arms restored. In some versions of this legend, Guan Yin manifested with 1,000 eyes and 1,000 arms, all the better for reaching out to all who suffer in the world. And so I'm going to pause there, at least to start, because I think there are some key things. Now, there's a little bit more to some of the legend and the myth, which maybe I'll talk about here through some real life kind of anecdotal stuff that comes up. But look, as we've said on this show many times, compliance is about elevating the services that and activities that our respective firms provide. And I think in the story of Guan Yin that, you know, we can see many elements of her ability to do just that and see a lot of different ties to compliance here. I think, look, at the outset, right, despite consistently being mistreated or viewed somewhat unceremoniously, you know, compliance frequently finds itself obligated to help those who may have been the perpetrators of that unfair mistreatment or characterization, or call it what you will. And I'll even add, you know, also anecdotally, depending on the ask, maybe sometimes feeling like they need to sacrifice an arm and a leg just to get it done on time, or wherever the case may be. But, you know, despite some of these headwinds, I think much like Bodhisattva Guan Yin, the best compliance officers and legal practitioners, you know, they receive these colleagues benevolently, I think was the word that the myth used, and oftentimes can work incredibly hard to help guide them on the path to securities regulations compliance, or I mean righteousness, whatever that might look like. I also kind of found it interesting, like that one of the other things that really struck me about the story, and then I'd be interested to hear both of your thoughts on it and if there were particular parts that spoke to you. But as indicated at the end of the story, you know, in many versions of the myth, Guan Yin transforms into the divine image of Bodhisattva with eyes and arms restored, but it's often manifested with 1,000 eyes and 1,000 arms. And one of the things that kind of struck me interesting about that is, again, part of the reason, you know, she has 1,000 eyes, 1,000 arms is for the all the better for reaching out to all who suffer in the world, right? And in this age that we live in right now, where, look, over the first 5 months of 2022, how much does it feel like the sands are shifting beneath our feet in the number of things that we are asked as compliance officers and legal practitioners just to try to keep up with, to help with the various levels of challenges and other issues and problems that people have in our industry, just in the new rulemaking that's occurred, let alone the ones that are even currently on the books and trying to keep up with that. And I also thought, in an age of data privacy and cybersecurity to cryptocurrency and NFTs, you know, compliance officers and legal practitioners are asked to be experts and to help so many different
people and parts of our firms and business units on so many different subject matters that it sometimes feels never ending. And I know personally, it can feel like sometimes you're like, one, you're getting pulled in 1,000 different directions. And two, that no matter how many arms and eyes you might have, it seems impossible to be able to get to everything that you'd like to in order to help enhance, right, your compliance programs and to help cure any of the compliance suffering, I'll call it, that's going on in, inside of your firm. So I don't know, Miriam, John, you know, was there particular things that stuck out to you about the story of Guanyin?
I like that there's redemption and on both sides, right? So the king may not be an impressive character early on, but he recognizes the error of his ways. And I like that, right? So I think that he learns, it's an extreme example, but all right, that's what makes it a myth. So I think that that's helpful that we can model, you know, that compliance can actually be a model and that it can be learned from. So I think that's one of the lessons.
Yeah, I like the idea that she is open to all who call out to her. You know, yeah. The idea that all who suffer can reach out, you know, call out to the Bodhisattva. And Patrick, I suspect it's not part of the original story, but I really like the term compliance suffering. It's a new phrase, but it's one I'm going to tell you right now. I will try and remember to attribute it to you, but I'm going to use it a lot. I like it. Compliance. I may even reach out to the celestial Bodhisattva of compliant suffering from time to time.
That's good. That is fantastic. You know what? That's actually, that's a good maybe segue, because one of the other things I wanted to mention were, in addition to that kind of origin story, I just wanted to mention briefly some of the other stories about, you know, Bodhisattva Guanyin and some of the other kind of more, maybe less well-known myths or legend around it, because, you know, speaking of compliance suffering, John, so one of the things that, you know, other popular stories involve Guanyin transforming often into unassuming characters to bring help to troubled people. And so I started to think about it, because even going back to like your, one of the themes from your myth, Miriam, and kind of being clever, right? Or a certain level of cunning, maybe. And I know, John, you mentioned that the story you're going to share with us may have something similar too. You know, that idea of kind of transforming into unassuming characters, or to transform ourselves into something that ultimately we know is going to resonate with the persons that we are trying to help, and or persons that we are trying to save. And I think compliance officers oftentimes, you know, depending on the communication styles of the people they're dealing with, depending on the personalities of, you know, the portfolio managers or the people in marketing or other folks, they often have to really be thoughtful and considerate about how they're going to be delivering that message and the types of things that they do. And they may transform that communication or the types of activities they're engaging in order to do that in a way that's ultimately going to resonate more inside the firm and with those business units.
What I love most about that story, actually, as I'm hearing it again, is that, you know, there's a phrase in Buddhism that, you know, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. And that's really where the compassion comes in. So if you compare that to compliance, like, new rules are inevitable, right? And it's going to be a heavy burden on the business. It's going to be heavy burden on everyone. But it's the attitude of how you deal with it is where the suffering comes in. And with the right attitude, you recognize that that's a cost of doing business. We're in a highly regulated industry. The regulations are designed for a good purpose, which is, of course, to protect the markets, to protect investors. And while it feels like a heavy burden, that's inevitable. How we choose to deal with it is on us. And compliance can really help feed that. So I think that's a great story.
Yeah. No, that's a great point, Miriam. And one of the quick ones I'll share, and then John, I would love to hear your story is, one of these legends takes place in a riverside village where it's been plagued by a gang of notorious bullies. Think like a marketing department on steroids, right? So they're in, after seeing the people's suffering, Guan Yin transforms into a beautiful young fisherwoman and pays the village a visit. And the gang's leader falls in love on sight and wishes to marry her. And then Guan Yin essentially, you know, through her own, you know, clever ways and whatever else, insists that instead he first memorize Buddhist scriptures, abstain from eating meat, and perform good deeds. And as a result of these activities, the entire posse, you know, relinquishes their weapons, changes their ways. The village becomes a delightful place. Everybody's in compliance with federal securities laws, and people everywhere come to know it no longer as a place of compliance suffering, copyright Pat Hayes 2022, but rather as a place of compassion. And look, while I don't think we would want compliance officers or legal practitioners to offer marriage or relationships in any way abiding for compliance policies and procedures, I definitely think it's fair to say that compliance officers should be and often are very resourceful in identifying the needs and interests of the business in a way that is ultimately going to help to drive adherence to some of those internal controls and policies and procedures. So,
and it goes to tone from the top. You get the top where they need to be, rest will follow.
It's also optimistic about human nature. Even the most notorious posse of Fisher Village bad guys can turn right. good with proper leadership from compliance.
That's right. Well, thank you all for indulging me in the mythology of Bodhisattva Guan Yin. I would love to turn now to Mr. John Walsh and hear from John on the myth or legend that he chose to share with us today.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, I'd like to tell a slightly different kind of classic story. And this is a story about Anansi, who is a spider. And he tells stories and has stories told about him. And Anansi's stories fill a great cultural space in our world, similar to the titans and gods of Europe and the bodhisattvas of Asia. Anansi was born in West Africa, and Africans carried him with them across the Atlantic Ocean. And he is today known as well in Jamaica as he is in Ghana. And just on a personal note, I grew up in the Caribbean. Well, at least I went to high school there, which I suppose is the most important part of growing up. And maybe because of that, I've early exposure, I've always loved Anansi stories. And so, Pat, Miriam, without further ado, I'll tell you Anansi story right now.
Perfect.
Good. All right. Well, Anansi, the story goes, is teeny tiny, but he is smart. And one day he found himself wondering why Lion owned everything and why he, Anansi, owned nothing. He thought and thought and thought about what he wanted, and he realized more than anything else in the world, he loved stories. He would love to own the stories. Lion should share, he thought. Why not stories? So Anansi went to Lion and bowed low. Oh, Lion, he said, you own everything. Lion smiled. But, Anansi continued, I own nothing. Lion chuckled and said, so what? Anansi bowed even lower and said, I want to own something. Lion roared with laughter. Just a small thing, Anansi continued, a very small thing. Can I own stories? Lion growled. Then he thought, if this little spider wants a story, I'll turn him into one. Well, Lion said, I will give you stories, but only if you do one thing for me. Do you agree? And Anansi said, yes, yes. Quickly, Lion said, you must give me snake. Then he turned and walked away. All the animals thought it was funny. Lion had made a fool of him. What a trick, the animal said. Snake is too big for Anansi. They laughed and laughed. Anansi wanted to crawl into his web and hide, but no, he said to himself, spiders are small, but they are brave. I will go and see Snake before I give up. He went to find Snake, and he saw it was true. Snake was big, much, much bigger than Anansi. When Snake saw him, he called out, have you come to take me to Lion? I don't think so. No, said Anansi, I could not. You are too big. I could never take you. Why? Anansi thought. Why? And he continued, you are the longest thing I have ever seen. Snake hissed with pride. Yes, Anansi said, you are longer than everything else in the world. Snake stretched himself. Well, Anansi added, except maybe, just maybe, for that piece of bamboo. What piece of bamboo? Snake hissed in anger and curled himself to strike. That piece right there, said Anansi, fear trembling in his voice. I think it's a little longer than you. No, shouted Snake, getting even angrier, curling even tighter and flashing his fangs. I am longer, Snake hissed. The bamboo just looks longer because I am curled and it is straight. You must uncurl me, Snake hissed. Do it now. Okay, said Anansi, if you insist. Anansi spun a web around Snake's tail at one end of the bamboo, unrolled him to his middle, spun another web there, then unrolled him to his head, where he spun a third web. When he was finished, Snake's head stuck out a little bit from the bamboo. Snake flicked out his forked tongue just to make sure he was longer. You are right, said Anansi. You are longer. Of course, yes, Snake. I knew it all along. His voice was full of pride. But wait, Snake called out when he saw Anansi scamper off. Where are you going? To get Lion, Anansi replied. I have a story for him. All of the other animals cheered. The end. Now, I love Anansi stories because Anansi's this little tiny spider. The only thing he has going for him are his wits. And yet lions, snakes, and there are lots of other stories involving lots of other animals. Nonetheless, Anansi always comes out on top. He also has a bit of a trickster in him. Miriam, when you were talking about prudence and cunning and clever, I was thinking, well, it's a bit of Anansi too. There's a bit of tricksterism there. But I have four morals that I'd like to draw from this story. And if you like that, I'll just start to run through.
That'd be great.
All right. Number one, compliance professionals often work with lions and sometimes with snakes. I think anybody can walk down the hall of their office and point to the office and think to themselves, by the way, being Anansi, don't say it out loud, snake, lion, lion, snake, lion. And if you've done that, you're living in Anansi's world. Number two, lesson number two, lions may have the power, but spiders have the smarts. And we all know butting heads and taking axes to heads, Miriam, doesn't work. That's not a good way to solve problems. We need a plan. And for me, one of the great moments in this story is when you can see Anansi's coming up with a plan. And he goes on to implement it. And when he does, doesn't matter how much bigger Snake is, Anansi can do it. Number three, if you spin your webs carefully, you can catch the biggest snakes. And I have to tell you, I tend, this is maybe me and my bias, I tend to see in Snake the big producer boasting about his production numbers and boasting that he or she could outsell anybody and doesn't really care about all this namby-pamby stuff slowing down production and doesn't notice the spider in the room slowly spinning his or her webs around what the producer is saying. And then fourth and finally, when you do catch the biggest snakes, all the other animals will cheer, even if they didn't before. And you have to wonder how much of it was because they were afraid. They want to root for you. Inside, they are rooting for you. They eventually will root for you. But they're depending on you to be the one that's brave. And of course, we all know Anansi is never afraid. And so that's my take, my four takeaways.
It's such a cool story. It's such a cool story. And I'm so glad that you shared it. And I completely agree with the four different items that you mentioned. Well, one of the things that struck me that I loved, well, one, I love the idea of kind of compliance being the underdog, right? A little bit, right? Because I think we often sometimes can feel a little bit like that. But the thing that I think I love most, or that struck me right away, and I made sure to write it down as you were talking, is this idea that compliance can be underestimated. And in fact, giving some credit to compliance for how creative they can be. I mean, people often, I think, when you think of compliance professionals, when you think of securities law practitioners or other folks, you think, look, you know, the business, I'll say, sometimes views that as, oh, they live in a black and white world, right? It's yes or no. It's you can do this, you can't do that. But in fact, the best compliance officers are in fact incredibly creative and often working tirelessly to help firms get from A to B, but to do so just staying within the white lines. And so I kind of like that element that was found throughout too.
I love this story, John. It's charming, but there's so many lessons. I think the four you mentioned were great. I think I love that he plays a long game, right? Because that's what compliance is. You don't necessarily get what you need and certainly not what you want right away. Annunzio gets discouraged, but he rebounds. And that's oftentimes, I think, you know, we all want resources when we're in compliance and law, and we don't get all the resources we need in the way we want. And we may have a vision of what the end's going to look like. That's another piece of this story, right? Like in the beginning, you think he's going to march with dragging a snake behind him, right? Well, you know, the ending looks different, right? We have to recognize that we might get what we want. It's just not going to look like we thought it was going to look. And I think that this crystallizes that so well, and to appreciate that moment is great.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think Annunzio is quite a character. And part of the thing that makes Annunzio a good character for a lot of these morals is, you know, there are times where he's kind of cutting a little close to the line. Now, in this story, he plays it straight. There are pieces, some of the versions of this story, he tries to do things like capture snake in a gourd or tie up snake with a rope. It's just really over the top. and it's not till he realizes that he has to use snake's own pride to trap him that he's going to win. But I kind of like it because it's the whole idea that it's black and white. Well, it's not. It's not. And Annunzio has to kind of walk close to the other side to understand how it will to make it work for him.
That's such a great point too, John. And it strikes in my head this idea of agency. I think because I think oftentimes as compliance officers, and I've worked with compliance officers and other folks inside of firms who, you know, kind of feel limited or relegated to their situation. And it's like, oh, well, I told them that, you know, we can't do X, Y, Z, but they're going to do it anyway. And that's just the way it is. And kind of, you know, but what I like about this story is the level of agency that he has when he says, you know what, like, I'm not going to accept that fate. Like, I'm not going to like just accept this lying down. No pun intended there with the snake and the stick. But like the idea that like instead, right, like I'm going to influence the story. Like I'm going to still use the powers that I have at my disposal to help influence the story in a way that ultimately is going to help craft the ending that I want to have happen. And like Miriam said, it may not be exactly what he had when he went to go meet with the lion to figure out what the ending was going to look like. But ultimately, he did get an ending that was a good landing spot for him. And he did it through agency of his own actions.
And he caught the snake.
And he got the snake.
He got the snake.
And I love that Annunzio understands the value of owning the narrative. He wants to own the stories.
Right. Yes. Well, Annunzio got to tell the story. Who knows what the snake really said? This is Anansi's telling of the story.
All right. That's a fair point, Ben.
That's great. Well, this has been awesome. I mean, I feel like this is, you know, this show caters to various levels of nerddom in compliance and history and mythology. And man, we've touched them all, from Metis to Guan Yin to Annunzio. And I thank you both immensely for coming on the show to share these incredibly entertaining and fun stories, but also to share them in a way that is meaningful to you, and that ultimately you can see some of the value of these stories and the lessons that you all have learned in your lives as securities law practitioners and as compliance officers and as regulators and everything in between. And so it really has been a pleasure having you both on the show today. Thank you so much for your time. And maybe we'll have to do a sequel to this at some point down the line and find some new myths and legends. But again, thank you very much, and look forward to having you back on the show here at some point.
Thank you both. This was a lot of fun.
The final part of today's show features another segment of Outtakes. As a quick reminder for some of our new listeners, if compliance were a TV show, think of this as the bloopers reel, where we look at entertaining, sometimes humorous, and always unsettling activities carried out of financial services firms that hopefully provide us all with a roadmap of what not to do when facing a similar situation or trying to avoid a similar compliance breakdown inside our respective firms. Essentially, leave these activities on the cutting room floor and outside your compliance program. In parallel civil and criminal actions, the SEC and DOJ charged a publicly traded healthcare company and its CEO with participating in a fraudulent COVID-19 test kit scheme. In the civil complaint, the SEC alleged that in several instances, the CEO falsely stated it had committed purchase orders to sell 2 million COVID-19 rapid test kits to a telehealth company, with another provision for an additional 2 million orders per week for 23 consecutive weeks. Additionally, the CEO falsely claimed that the company had a legitimate supplier lined up to provide the test kits to sell. Further, the SEC alleged that the company and CEO were aware there was no purchase order from a buyer and that there was no agreement in place for a supplier to provide the test kits, but stated as such anyway. The CEO apparently falsely claimed that the supplier had proper FDA emergency use authorizations for the test kits. It did not. And based on that information, the share price for the company increased by 425%. The SEC then alleges that the CEO then used those proceeds from the share price increase to satisfy large debts to a separate vendor. And ultimately, without ever delivering a single test kit, the CEO claimed that the purchase order and agreement with the supplier had been terminated. As a result, the SEC found that the company and its CEO violated the Securities Act, specifically the section around a fraudulent interstate transaction, 17A, another section of the Exchange Act, regulation of the use of manipulative and deceptive devices, Exchange Act section 10B, and employment of manipulative and deceptive devices under SEA rule 10B5. To settle the civil charges, the company and its CEO have agreed to an officer and director bar against the CEO, disgorgement of nearly $500,000, and a $125,000 civil penalty. In the parallel criminal action, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of New Jersey and the DOJ fraud section charged the CEO with two counts of securities fraud for his participation in the alleged scheme, with the indictment claims causing over $116 million in investor losses. The first count alleges that the CEO engaged in securities fraud by making material misrepresentations and omissions to investors, leading investors to purchase shares in the company at the artificially inflated prices, and selling for a loss, causing, again, over $116 million in losses. The second count that the CEO allegedly obtained promises, money, and property in connection the second count added that the CEO allegedly obtained promises and money and property in connection with the purchase and sale of the securities at the artificial price. These parallel actions illustrate law enforcement's heightened scrutiny of, you know, pandemic frauds, COVID frauds. And this was even recently foreshadowed or discussed in President Biden's State of the Union address. It also reflects an investigative focus on some of these sophisticated corporate actors as distinct from the DOJ's earlier prosecutions of individuals who were securing COVID-related loans or other type of stuff under false pretenses. And as the pandemic continues to evolve, that doesn't mean that legal practitioners and compliance professionals can let their guard down one bit, right, as we move into this endemic stage and as things continue to develop. And it might be a really good time for those compliance officers and legal practitioners listening to this podcast to help re-educate a lot of the advisors that are going to be, you know, touching clients on a consistent basis, those folks, relationship managers inside your firm, to kind of instruct them to continue to be on the lookout for these types of fraudulent schemes and help counsel their clients accordingly. And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, CALFI and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guests, Miriam Lefkowitz and John Walsh, for coming on today's show and entertaining us with some of their wonderful stories of myth and legend, and how we can use those lessons discussed to better improve the compliance programs inside our firms. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast, or on Twitter using the handle @ compliancepod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceInContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.